Welcome to Real Conservative Talk. You are now entering an unsafe space.
What's up? Welcome back to the RCT podcast. And I want to start off by saying, if you haven't already and you want to go check out video content for the show, you can go and subscribe to the YouTube channel, which is at RCT Network. And on there, you'll find some shorter versions of videos talking about a lot of the topics that we discuss in length here on the audio podcast. Also, don't forget to go and subscribe to our Substack, which is the RCT Report. I'll put the link in the description for the podcast below. And it's a free subscription, doesn't cost you anything. You can go and read about topics that I go even further into detail when I write, the same ones that I discuss here on the show. Now, if you want to do the paid subscription for that Substack, you can do that as well. It's $5 a month, and that would be just to support the show to help us keep bringing you good quality content. But other than that, it's your choice, and it is a free subscription. If you want to send us some referrals, we will also give you the paid version of the subscription for free based on how many referrals you give us, and that would also be appreciated as well. But those are just some housekeeping announcements right there. Now, I want to start off today by just real quick talking about something that just happened, actually. Just saw that a serviceman over in Israel, in front of the Israel embassy, this is a U.S. serviceman, set themselves on fire. And I believe it was in protest of Israel's war against Hamas, calling it genocide. I just watched the video of him committing suicide. And let me tell you something, it is heartbreaking. It is very, very difficult to watch. First of all, I know that our veterans have so many demons they deal with, and the suicide rate is just so unacceptable in that community. Now, this person, I believe, was active duty. You know, first of all, regardless of political opinion, I don't care if you support Israel, if you support Hamas, it doesn't matter. For something to drive someone to the point where they go and are willing to light themselves on fire, there's obviously more than some political ideology going on. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I know people protest like this, you know, around the world, but this is crazy. Like, there's obviously some kind of mental health issue that was helping fuel this. And I just want to say, you know, if there's something that you don't like in the world, you can't change it by being dead or incapacitated. If you want to make a change, you have to be able to function. You need to be alive. There's no reason to kill yourself. You can't do any good for the world by being dead. So please reach out, get help. And just understand that, you know, you're loved and you're appreciated, and there's no reason to go that far. Now, the main topic of discussion today is somewhat of a build off of what I discussed in the last show when it came to voting. But this is even deeper. Now, I saw a video come up on my YouTube. It was a short video by Robert Reich, who was the, I call him communist, the communist, he's really just a communist. I don't even know how to really describe him. I mean, he is the former Secretary of Labor. He obviously is very in favor of communist ideology, socialist ideology, very against capitalism, and hardcore leftist. He had a video, and I like watching his videos because I obviously like combating the videos. I like going against it and discussing it and why he's wrong, because he is wrong about a lot. But he brought up something that was I didn't know about, and it's called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Now, I haven't heard anyone talk about this. If you're on the left, you probably say, oh, yeah, we know about this. But if you're on the right, I don't know of anyone on the right that has brought this up. Now, I'm going to play the short video, the audio for it, by Robert Reich, explaining the NPVIC, or National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And we're going to discuss it, but here it is.
National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. How does it work? All that's needed is for states with a total of at least 270 electoral votes to agree to award all their electoral votes to the presidential candidate who wins the national popular vote. The movement to do this is already underway. Together, states in the compact have 195 electoral votes. So we just need a few more states with at least 75 electors to join the compact, and it's done. Popular vote laws have recently been introduced in Michigan and Minnesota, which, if passed, would bring the total to 220. If your state is not already a member, I urge you to contact your state senators and reps to get your state on board.
So, as you heard him say, there were actually two states, Minnesota and Maine, that were looking to pass this. And I believe this video came out about 9 months ago. Since then, Minnesota has actually enacted this into law. So there's currently 16 states plus Washington, D.C., so 17 jurisdictions, totaling 205 electoral votes now, not the 195 that he said. It's actually 205 now. And I think I was reading where Maine had the decision up in their own Supreme Court, and I'm not sure what the ruling is on it. I'll have to go and check it out. But 8 other states have passed this law and this compact in at least one chamber of their government as well. So this is something that is actually, like, it has some momentum and is a potential threat. Like, the reason why this is bad, first of all, the main reason is the Electoral College is constitutionally mandated. So to abolish the Electoral College, like the Democrats actually want to do, and we'll get into why here in a second, but to abolish it, they would need 2/3 vote in the House and the Senate, and then they would actually need 75% of the states to ratify the new constitutional amendment that would thus abolish the Electoral College. And that's very difficult. But taking this route with the NPVIC laws at the state level, they can actually achieve bypassing the Electoral College and turning the United States into a popular vote system. And they don't even need a vote at the congressional level. And they can achieve this with less than half of the states agreeing to allocate their votes to whoever candidate wins the national vote. They can do it with less than 25 states. In fact, like I said, there's 16 current states that have put this into law, and there's 8 that have passed it. Those 8, I think, hold the total of 78 votes. So 205 plus 78 is well over the 270 majority votes needed by the electoral system to elect a president. So it's basically a way to utilize the Electoral College against itself and turn us from a constitutional republic into a popular democracy, which is the very thing that our founding fathers didn't want. Like, the very thing they didn't want, for good reason, too. Now, I have a lot of information I want to go over with you today, and I'm going to try and do my best to not jump around because I want to cover some historical aspects. I want to cover some numbers to give you context on how this would shift elections. And I also want to go over the intention and the motivations for why the left would actually support a popular vote system. The first thing I want to do, though, is I want to go over the numbers. Now, I spent a lot of time yesterday because I actually wanted to do the podcast yesterday about this topic. But I spent so much time just going over a bunch of different numbers with some of the elections to see, first of all, why would this be in the benefit of the Democratic Party? And the reason I say why would it be in the benefit of the Democratic Party is because my personal opinion and how I approach things, like my baseline, when I'm trying to determine what the intention of specific policy being pushed forwards by either the Republicans or Democrats, all comes down to what does that party have to gain? What does this elected official benefit? Like, what are they benefiting from this? Because, and I think this is actually a valid theory now, any legislation put forward by any elected official, in my opinion, gives them some kind of benefit. And that is why we can't get term limits passed in Congress. That is why we can't get single subject bills passed in Congress, why they never want to do that. They always want to pile on all these other things into every bill. That's why we have a Ukraine funding bill when it's really supposed to be for the border. You know, they come out and they say, oh, we have this border bill. We're going to secure the border. But like less than 10% of the money in that bill is actually allocated to doing anything with the border, and it's really 90% of it's going to Ukraine and Israel. There's some kind of motivation, some kind of underlying intention when it comes to all legislation put forward by someone in Congress. That is just my opinion. Therefore, because the left, and when I say the left, I'm only saying that because they're the ones that overwhelmingly, like almost 100%, are the only ones that support the popular voting system. Maybe some independents are in there, but the Republicans definitely don't. Why is it that they support this? Well, because they have the most to gain. And here's why. If this system was in place, the last time a Republican won the popular vote on the national level for the presidency was George Bush won it against John Kerry in 2004. So the last four elections in a row, the popular vote was won by the Democratic presidential candidate. Obviously, we know that the last four elections was not won by the Democrats because Trump won in 2016. But Trump never won the popular vote. Clinton won the popular vote in 2016. Out of the seven out of the last eight presidential elections, the popular vote was won by the Democratic Party. Again, the only one being 2004 with George Bush. The popular vote on the national level was won by Clinton in both terms, by Al Gore the first time against George Bush, both times by Obama, by Clinton, and then this last time by Joe Biden. So that means if this NPVIC compact was in place starting eight elections ago, let's just say, then the Democrats would have held presidential power 28 out of the last 32 years. Let me say that again. They would have held power 28 out of the last 32 years. Now, currently, with our electoral system, presidential power has been more evenly distributed amongst the two. And the Republicans have held power 12 out of the last 32 years. So you can see where the current process we have, the Democrats are still able to win, but the Republicans have a chance. Therefore, the Republican voters are more represented in the presidency, and power is more distributed. You can see why the Democrats want a popular voting system. It is no secret that I honestly believe it will be very difficult for a Republican candidate to ever win the popular vote ever again in history. Ever again. But it's not unlikely for them to win the Electoral College. And that is what is keeping totalitarian control from one party from existing in the United States. And you can say, well, Michael, it's only the presidency. Let me, again, go into more detail. Yeah, maybe it's just the presidency, but who elects or who appoints the Supreme Court justices? The president does. And the left is often arguing about how we need to expand the court, add judges, because they're highly conservative right now, and it's not fair that the Republicans got to choose the Supreme Court justices and that they're in there for life. That was almost, it's just a matter of circumstance. That's all that was. That a Republican president was in power at the time that these Supreme Court justices were appointed. It could have easily gone the other way. But if they were able to hold power almost every single presidential election, guess what? There will never be another conservative Supreme Court justice put into power ever again. Ever again. And the other thing is that the powers in the House and the Senate often shift. And if they often shift, that means that you are going to have both a Republican House sometimes, you're going to have a Republican Senate sometimes, you're going to have a Democratic Senate sometimes, and vice versa, right? And every so often, you're going to get where you have a Democrat House, a Democrat Senate. Joe Biden did this his first term. By the way, in Trump's term, he had a Republican House and Senate as well. But when you look at what you're able to get done on the presidential level, a lot of it comes when you can have both the House and the Senate, because the president has veto authority. And he also has final approval on legislation that is passed. You either sign off on it or veto it. The vice president also has the tie-breaking vote in the Senate. So even if the Senate is tied on a 50-50 split and the House belongs to the Democrats, if they can get a 50-50 vote in the Senate on legislation that Republicans don't like, then they can have a Democratic vice president still vote in favor of it and send it up to the president and pass the bill. And people are thinking, well, yeah, but think about how hard it's been to get for Joe Biden to get things passed and how hard it was for Trump to get things passed, even with a Democrat Senate, even with a Democrat House at the same time. It is difficult, but it becomes less difficult when you have a long period of time where you hold executive power. So all you're doing is you're taking the power that has been diluted and you're concentrating it even more. And just to give you more of an illustration on how serious this is, I want to go back to the 2016 election with Clinton and Trump. If you look at the numbers, so Trump won that election 304-227 with the electoral voting system. If the NPVIC was in place, the outcome of this election would have gone in Hillary Clinton's favor, and she would have won 296 to 242. That's 538 electoral votes. She would have won 296 to 232. So it would have changed the results of the election, again, from 304 in Trump's favor to 227 against Clinton, in favor of Clinton, 296 to 242. Now, to give you more context, Clinton won 20 states And then she also won Washington, D.C., so 21 voting jurisdictions. But she won 20 states of the 50. Donald Trump won 30 states, which means that Donald Trump got the majority vote, the majority of the popular vote at the state level in 30 states. And Clinton only got the majority of the popular vote in 20 states, and then the majority of the popular vote in Washington, D.C., which is not a state, it's a district. So that means if the national popular vote was in place, Clinton could have won with a minority of states. Because again, they're still using the electoral voting system. It's just changing how electoral votes are allocated. And the eight states that have already passed this that would have been flipped in 2016. So Trump won Arizona, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Michigan, North Carolina, Nevada. And all of those states have passed the MPVIC in at least one chamber of government in that state. And so I bring them forward because they already have some sort of momentum and seriousness when it comes to enacting the national vote into law. So it would have actually allocated the votes from Oklahoma, who, by the way, I don't think Clinton won a single county in Oklahoma. And I know Joe Biden didn't win any counties in Oklahoma. It would have allocated all seven of Oklahoma's seven electoral votes in favor of Hillary Clinton. Now that brings me back to the Democrats' argument on why we need a national vote and how hypocritical it is. The main basis of their argument is saying that the current electoral system basically disenfranchises voters in states that aren't swing states and states that are overwhelmingly in favor of one side. So, Oklahoma, who votes incredibly in favor of the Republican Party, they're saying that all the Democratic voters in that state are basically disenfranchised and their vote holds no weight. And going to a popular vote will give them a more weighted vote because the popular vote has a, you know, one vote, one person, equal weight across the whole country. And the same is said in California, where California votes overwhelmingly in favor of the Democratic Party right now. And all the Republican voters in that state are basically disenfranchised because no matter how they vote, California is still going to vote in favor of the Democratic Party. The thing is that the interest of California and the interest of Oklahoma are two separate things. The United States is such a big and vast country. We have different cultures. We have different people. We have different economies in all the different states, different laws, everything. So to say that the people in California should have more, you know, as much say or the same say or more control, I would say, because the way national voting will work out, than the people in Oklahoma, and that the people in California get to dictate what is right for the people in Oklahoma is not a good thing because they don't know what's good for the people in Oklahoma. You can't have the actor and the media person in LA getting to dictate almost 100% of the time what is favorable for the farmers in Oklahoma or the cowboys in Oklahoma. You just can't. There's a difference between being a minority voter at the state level and being a minority voter at the national level. And when the Democrats are arguing that, well, all the Democratic voters in Oklahoma are disenfranchised because Oklahoma is always going to vote Republican and they never have a say. First of all, using the word disenfranchised in that context is not correct. To be disenfranchised, that means that you lack the ability to practice the right. That means that you are not legally able to vote at all. And the only people who aren't enfranchised voters in the United States as of right now are those who are not citizens of the United States, those who are under the age of 18, and in a lot of states, if you're a felon. So when the Democrats start saying we need to enfranchise more voters, and the policies that they're putting forward are just enfranchising voters, that's actually has nothing to do with the national vote and what impact that would have. In fact, their agenda based on enfranchising voters means that they're trying to add who can actually participate in elections. That means that they want to either lower the voting age to add new voters, or make it to where non-citizens can vote, or make it to where felons can vote. Because that's the only way you can actually enfranchise more voters in today's elections. And the reason why they're being hypocritical when it comes to, you know, trying to give voters equal say on a national level is now, based on this NPVIC compact, if it were to take place, let's say Oklahoma somewhat agreed, I can't believe that it's actually has passed one chamber of government in Oklahoma, but if they agree to do this and allocate their electoral votes to whatever candidate wins the national popular vote, if every county in Oklahoma votes in favor of Donald Trump in 2024, let's say it's a Trump versus Biden election, if every voter in Oklahoma votes in favor of Donald Trump, but Biden wins the popular vote on the national level, then all seven of Oklahoma's electoral votes go to Biden. You literally just disenfranchised and completely went against what the overwhelming majority of Oklahoma voters wanted to happen. You disenfranchising, if you're saying that the current electoral college disenfranchises minority voters in the states, what your idea is going to do is disenfranchise the vast majority voters in the majority of states, because Republicans, a lot of times, even though they win or lose the national popular vote, they win the majority of states. Like I said, in 2016, Trump won 30 states compared to Clinton's 20. So you're saying that the majority vote in each of those 30 states that Trump won in 2016 should go to Hillary Clinton because she won the popular vote, because the 20 states that Clinton won have huge metropolitan areas where Democrats enjoy a substantial majority of votes. To give you more perspective on why Democrats want this, in 2020, Joe Biden received 35% of his 81 million votes, and I'm not here to argue whether or not he got 81 million, but of the 81 million votes that were counted, Joe Biden got 35% of those, which was 697,651 votes, sorry, from only 50 counties. Now, there's 3,143 counties in the United States. So, coming from 1.59% of counties, Joe Biden received 35% of his 81,284,666 votes. Think about that. Let me say that again. From 50 counties, which equals 1.59% of the total amount of counties in the whole United States, Joe Biden received 35% of his 81,284,666 votes. The total amount of votes he received was 28,697,651 votes from only 50 counties. If you look at the largest 25 counties in the United States, Joe Biden won 24 of the 25. The only county Trump won was Suffolk County in New York, which was number 25 of the top 25 on the list. So the smallest of the top 25. In those 24 counties that Biden won, in almost all of them, he received over 60% of the vote, and in a substantial amount received upwards of 75% of the vote, and in like six of them received almost or over 80% of the vote. So those 50 counties, let's go back to the 50 counties that I went and calculated, because a lot of those were just other counties that were adjacent to the 25 largest counties. They were basically consisted of 28 different cities or townships. All of them were within a state that borders the coast or a major waterway. And they, none of them consisted of any cities that were in the internal United States. The other argument I hate hearing is, well, land doesn't vote, Michael. People vote. Yes. But let me tell you something. Land grows food. Land mines materials and minerals. And land has a major contribution to the economy. Therefore, the people who are working that land have a much needed say when it comes to how things are done at the congressional level. And it would not be a good thing to give, like I said prior, the media people and the actors and the movie producers in LA the power to basically elect the most powerful position in the world almost 100% of the time and have them dictate what is right for those people who are feeding and supplying all of the materials and necessities to life to the United States and the people of the United States. And what is even more diabolical to me is that the left, but really, let's say the people in LA, the people in the cities who are so separated from everyday life, from what how we get our food, right? The people in the cities aren't seeing the cattle operations and where our meat comes from, or the hunting that takes place, and the farming that takes place, and what goes into that. You know, they're so separated and sheltered from it. And a lot of the people who support this massive climate agenda that we are throwing trillions of dollars into around the world, they're from these cities like LA or New York. Why is it that the people who overwhelmingly are in favor of these climate policies that will adversely impact the farming abilities and the oil industries and the mining industries in the United States adversely impact them in a very bad way and make it much more difficult for them to operate. Now they get a whole say in how the president of the United States is elected, and the internal workings of the United States has to basically do whatever they want at that point. That is why the Electoral College is so great, is because it gives power and say to the farmers in Iowa. It gives them an ability to be represented at not just the House of Representatives level or the Senate level, but also the presidential level. And it allows for this well-oiled machine that is the United States to keep operating. It was a very, very, very smart system of government that our founding fathers gave us. And they took all of this into consideration. By the way, what I said about the left being the ones who are gaining the most by switching to a national popular vote, and what I said about politicians pushing forward ideas and laws that only benefit them, I can back this up. Who pushed forward the mail-in ballot initiative to basically allow mail-in ballot voting of all ages and basically unrestricted to supposedly protect voters from the COVID-19 virus? The Democratic Party did. And guess what? Who overwhelmingly benefited from mail-in ballot voting in the presidential election and the election in 2022 as well? The Democratic Party overwhelmingly did. Remember, we all remember how the Donald Trump was winning. Come the night of November 3rd, and everyone was saying, yeah, but the mail-in ballot votes haven't been counted, and those are going to go in favor of the Democratic Party. And what do you know? In just a few days of counting mail-in ballots that were arriving after November 3rd, Joe Biden's lead not only surpassed Trump, but went way above Trump. Like, he got a substantial amount of the mail-in ballot votes. That's why only the Democratic Party supports them. Who is trying to push forward laws that eliminate voter ID? The Democrats, because they know they will benefit from it. Who is trying to pass legislation that allows non-citizens to vote in elections? And some of you are going to say, no, that's never happened. Actually, it has. Guess what? The other day, I just read the article and played the video on the podcast about how this New York Supreme Court had to overturn legislation that was passed, not put forward to a vote, legislation that was actually passed by the Democratic Party in New York that allowed non-citizens to vote in their elections. They want these immigrants to be able to vote. Why? Because they know they will benefit from it. Why is it that the Democratic Party is being so lax on the border crisis? Because they're now able to send these illegals to key states like California, New York, and Illinois. They're sending them to cities like LA, San Francisco, New York City, and Chicago. Just to give you an idea here, all of those states lost an electoral vote because they lost population on the last census. A lot of their voters during COVID, because of the terrible policies of the left, moved away, and they moved to states like Texas, Tennessee, and Florida. Guess who gained an equal amount of electoral votes in relation to how many electoral votes California, Illinois, and New York lost? Texas, Nashville, or not Nashville, Tennessee, and Florida. So Florida, Tennessee, and Texas's electoral gains was the loss of those other states, because all of those people moved to those states because they didn't like those policies. Well, guess where they're shipping all the illegal migrants now? They're shipping them to California, Illinois, and New York. And come the next census, which I believe will be done in 2024, will be done after the election, obviously, but they're not looking for this election, they're looking for the next one. They're going to fill out a census, and these illegals do not have to state whether or not they're a citizen. There's no citizenship question on the census. It's only about residency. And that means if you're living, so you can have these illegals fill out the census, and they are counted towards the state's population. That in turn dictates how many representatives they have, how many electoral votes they have. And it is a way for them to, even if these people don't vote, to gain electoral power. So these are just things to think about. Now, this Rock the Vote organization, I'm going to put links to the websites in the description for podcasts below, but this Rock the Vote organization is where I've read a lot about the objectives of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And they go on to say that the Electoral College is basically a system that was brought into existence to protect and promote the power of Southern white voters, along with the Three-Fifths Compromise, which allowed wealthy slave owners to leverage the slave population against the North's superior population count and even the playing field. The Democratic Party has since waged a war against the Electoral College and has claimed it to be a remnant of institutional racism and undemocratic. First of all, it is undemocratic because it was never meant to be democratic. The Founding Fathers didn't want us to be democratic. That was like the one thing they wanted us to avoid. Like I've said 100 times, to say it's racist, and I love when they bring the Three-Fifths Compromise into it, because we're actually going to address this. But the Three-Fifths Compromise, Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution of the United States, and they're discussing basically how they will determine eligibility for a person in the House of Representatives and how the amount of representatives from each state will be determined. And what it says here says representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to the respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. So, according to these leftist organizations that are saying it's racist, saying that all black people were then, by the Constitution, only counted as 3/5 of a person. They weren't important enough to be counted as one whole person because the United States was racist. That is not true. In fact, where does it say black people in there? It doesn't. It says that Native Americans weren't taxed weren't counted because it was also talking about tax apportionment. But it says that everyone is counted as a whole person, and anyone who is a free person is counted as one whole person. That means if you were a black person in the South that was free, you were counted as one whole person. And guess what? There were free black people in the South, and some of them even owned slaves. And the black slave owner was counted as one whole person, and the black slaves were counted as 3/5 because they were enslaved. That's what they were getting at. Anyone who was in slavery was counted as 3/5. The reason why they could not count the slaves either entirely or not at all, here's the justification behind that. One, they knew slavery was wrong. Yes, Jefferson was a slave owner. Washington was a slave owner. A lot of the founding fathers were slave owners. But they knew slavery was wrong. They wanted it to be abolished. But at that time, they had to actually deal with the fact that the states were going to have problems with going to war against each other. And they were trying to figure out a way to form the government that would actually keep peace among the Union and not have these states always at each other's throats. If they counted a slave entirely, then they were giving more power to the slave owners in the South. This was not done by the slave owners. The slave owners did not want the slaves to be counted as 3/5 to leverage power over the northern states. Why would they not have wanted the slaves to be one whole person? Because that would have given them more power. So it's a little contradicting. And the person who came up with the 3/5 number actually dilutes power of the Southerners because they can't count their slaves as one whole person. It also is a compromise, which means they negotiated this. So it was between counting them as one whole person or counting them not at all. You have to understand the motives behind this, again, was trying to keep states from going to war with each other. And to do this, they had to get states to agree to be a part of one union. The only way they could do this was by getting the support of the slave owners in the South. To them, the trade-off was, well, slavery is very bad, but it would be even worse if slavery exists and were at war with each other. So it was really just taking one problem at a time. Now, for them to argue that the 3/5 number was there to give the slave owners more power, it may have given them more power than if the slaves weren't counted at all, but it did not give them more power compared to the superior population of the North because the North didn't have slaves. Well, some northern states did, but they weren't able to count them either as a whole person. So think about this, especially back then when only a certain portion of the population was allowed to vote in elections, say rich white landowners. they still determined how many representatives each state had based on the state's population, regardless of whether or not those people could actually vote. What determines it, and this goes back to what I said about the census with the illegal migrants, what determines it is anyone living in that state. So if one rich white landowner has a wife who's not allowed to vote either, and three kids, well, that's still five people counted towards the population of that state and used to calculate how many representatives will come out of that state. Then on the flip side, you now have a slave owner who has one rich white person who then owns 100 slaves. What they didn't want is to give a one whole count to each one of those 100 slaves, because now you have a situation where that slave owner has voting power to elect more representatives and have more power in Congress, because he's able to leverage the one person count for each one of his slaves. They could just buy slaves. They could just increase the population of their state, and they would then have full power when it came to the House of Representatives. So when you are telling me that the three-fifths compromise was brought forth because of some underlying racial motive, it's not true. Nowhere does it have anything to do with race in the writing. It says anyone else who is not a free person is counted as three-fifths. It's not because they hated the people who were enslaved, or they hated black people. Black people just happened to be the people that were enslaved, and they hated the idea of slavery. And because they hated the idea of slavery, they didn't want to count each slave as a total person, because that would give more power to the people who owned the slaves. The slaves weren't allowed to vote. So why would it be a good thing ever to say everybody, free or enslaved, is counted as one person, we're treating them as one whole human being, when it came to the count of tax apportionment and representation, even though these poor people down here who have no control over their lives are nothing more than an entire person count when it came to the power of these slave states? In fact, it's kind of anti-racist, I would say, to have that three-fifths compromise. And it would be even more anti-racist if they didn't count them at all. But they had to compromise. Now, how does that correlate to today? Now, they say, the left is they, that this is still a racial institution, and that the Electoral College was basically born out of this racial ideology. And I'm sitting here trying to find out where, because based off of what the three-fifths compromise actually says, there's not one person today other than illegal immigrants, because I would argue that they are being counted wholly when they should be counted as three-fifths, because they are being treated as slaves by the left. But there's not one black person in the United States today that is counted as a three-fifths count towards the representation in Congress. Not one. No one is treated as a three-fifths person when it comes to the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution of the United States actually has an umbrella over every single citizen in the United States equally. To say that it's racist is not only lacking historical knowledge, but also just it's agenda-driven. The national popular vote is agenda-driven. It's a way to completely invalidate not just the votes, but the reasons to vote for majority voters in the majority of the states. It's a way to suppress Republican votes. And I hate when they say that you have Democrat votes in a state like Oklahoma or Mississippi or in these southern states that are being suppressed because it doesn't matter, because of our electoral system, their votes don't count because they know that the Republicans will win 100% of the time in that state and that the electoral votes will go to the Republican president. So they're willing, in order to solve this problem, they're willing to then suppress the majority votes in those states in order to please the majority vote in minority amount of states. There, and that to me is so wild that they can draw this conclusion. And the reason why this has any momentum is because people in the United States have such a poor education when it comes to our government. And I read this article, and this is just, again, more numbers in context. There's an article by NBC where they did a study, and this is back in 2008. It says a majority of Americans from all backgrounds struggled to come up with the correct answers in a quiz about American history by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. It says 2,500 randomly selected Americans were asked 33 basic questions that pertain to history and civic literacy. And 71% of them received an average score of 49% or got an F on the test. The quiz reveals that over twice as many people know Paula Abdul was a judge on American Idol than knew that the phrase government of the people, by the people, for the people comes from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. The study finds that only half of U.S. adults can name all three branches of government, and just 54% know that the power to declare war belongs to Congress. Almost 40% incorrectly said that it belongs to the president. Now, in their defense on that one, this is done in 2008, I will say, while you should know that the power to declare war belongs to the Congress, I would say it's pretty reasonable to think it belongs to the president because George Bush went out and freaking invaded an entire country with no congressional approval. You know, so I can see where that one actually gets pretty confusing there. Just saying. But it also says those who have held elected office lack civic knowledge. 43%, and these are people who have held elected office, 43% do not know that the Electoral College is a constitutionally mandated assembly that elects the president. Think about that. It says those who have held elected office lack civic knowledge. 43% of them do not know that the Electoral College is a constitutionally mandated assembly that elects the president. One in five of them thinks that it trains those aspiring for higher office or was established to supervise the first televised presidential debate. Hold on. This study found, again, I'm going to say this, those who have held elected office lack civic knowledge. 43% of them do not know the Electoral College is a constitutionally mandated assembly that elects the president. And one in five thinks it trains those aspiring for higher office or was established to supervise the first televised presidential debates. That's mind-blowing. This is in 2008. So 43%. Of our elected officials don't even know what the freaking Electoral College is. I would say that if you take that number, and then it would be even more of a percentage, probably closer to 50% don't know what the Electoral College is with the base general population. So how can you sit here and advocate for the elimination of a system that you don't even know what it is? And believe that we should enact a system that you do know what it is, but you have no historical context on how bad your democratic system has historically played out and the consequences that result from it. How can we keep electing people that have no knowledge of our government? And this is why we are in danger. This is why we are on the verge of really going downhill here. Because, again, 43% of elected officials, and this is in the state of California because this is NBC Los Angeles, didn't even know what the Electoral College was. They thought it was something that trains election officials, I think it said, right? trains those aspiring for higher office. Really? This is sick. This is who is passing these bills and looking out for the people. These are the type of people, these uneducated, interest-driven people are the ones that the founding fathers actually anticipated trying to take over power and built our government in such a way that they would be limited in achieving their objectives. This is why it's important to teach proper history and not teach history based on a racial lens or a cultural lens. Just teach it as it is.